This podcast is an extract from my third book, The Tracks of My Tires, A Life in Cars, by Jeff Dendle. The book is available on Amazon as a print copy or an e-book. The Tracks of My Tires, A Life in Cars. For my generation, cars were a rite of passage, and I can chart much of my life through the cars I've owned and my time spent in them, which is not insignificant. Previous generations, such as my parents, were the first generation where car ownership became almost universal, but that change also happened within my lifetime. Certainly when I was in school, it wasn't always the case that school friends owned a car in their family. So often, weekend outings in our early family cars may have been accompanied by friends from families without a car. The writings document the cars I've owned through my life and my experiences with them. Some of them are funny in retrospect, but maybe less so at the time. Maybe some of the experiences are mundane, but this lays no claim to be memoirs of a Formula One racing driver. Those are available, I'm sure. Instead, there are a series of anecdotes that may strike chords amongst readers from their own experiences with the horseless carriage that's come to dominate our lives and times. I apologise in advance for any technical inaccuracies that will be down to a mixture of amnesia, ignorance and antipathy to accuracy. My own first car was a Charles Metal pedal car, which I soon grew out of, and when it was passed on to my younger brother, although in any event the small size of our childhood garden limited the attraction of this early venture into the world of motoring. In childhood, model cars were important, and the ownership of a scale model garage with a lift, ramp and a showroom behind a curved Perspex window was an early introduction to the enticing world of car dealerships. In recent years, I've started a small collection of miniatures of some of the cars I've owned, and photos of these appear in the book as an appendix. I'm aware that driving is becoming less popular amongst subsequent generations, particularly city dwellers. A number of factors are apparently influencing this, ranging from environmental concerns to the cost of lessons. Who knows? Maybe they're waiting for self-driving flying cars from Elon Musk. Before I passed my driving test, I experienced a false entry into the world of motorised two wheels with the acquisition of a Vespa scooter. For the princely sum, I think, of £15, I acquired a 10-year-old metallic blue scooter. Although initially pleased with its ownership, it was not a happy experience. The only mechanical transport that I've owned that was less reliable was a four-wheel ride-on lawnmower many years later. I spent more time maintaining it than cutting grass with it. Other friends also had bikes and scooters of mixed reliability. The main problem with mine was a troublesome cable change for the gears, and I can remember a number of slow returns home with the gearbox stuck in first or second gear. We lived up a hill at the time, so the alternative of pushing it home was not an attractive one. Unlike a number of my friends, I don't remember any accidents on it. Maybe it wasn't mobile often enough for them to occur. I didn't take my motorbike test, so I was unable to graduate to larger engine motorbikes, which was probably just as well. If I'm going to experience rapid acceleration, I would prefer it to be on four wheels wearing a seatbelt. Once I passed my driving test, I left the world of two wheels with no real reluctance. A couple of my school friends had taken and passed their driving test before I had, and this being the 1960s, the cars they drove, normally owned by their mothers, were minis, and when I did take a few driving lessons and entered for my test, it was also in a mini. Compared to the cars of today, and particularly the 21st century BMW Mini, they were cars of a different complexion. The first difference was their size. They looked tiny and were low to the ground, with very small wheels pushed out to the four corners. Inside, they seemed implausibly to have more space than you would think from the outside. Some of this space was achieved by pushing the inside close to the outside, that is, neglecting any thick insulation panels. The lowness and lack of sound deadening allowed a greater sensation of speed, amplified by the noise of the engine that sounded as if it was in the passenger compartment with you. This was described as giving a sporting characteristic, an impression confirmed to owners by the success of the cars in rallying, including winning the famous Monte Carlo rally. They would ignore the fact that the rally winner was a Mini Cooper S that had been tuned by a team of rally mechanics. This was an inconvenience. So in a world yet to be subjected to airbags, seatbelt laws and breathalysers, Minis were often driven as if in rallies. This was particularly true of my school friends in their mother's Minis. I remember returning in a following car from an outing to a country pub near Llandilo to spot a friend's car sitting on a lawn of a bungalow on a tight bend facing towards the road and with the occupants clambering out to be harangued by the resident over the recently created gap in his hedge caused by the Mini losing control and spinning off the road. I think it was pushed back through the hedge and then driven back home. My driving lessons were in a Mini, but additional practice was in my father's car, a Hillman Imp. This was a rival to the Mini and less common, but innovative in different ways. Firstly, the engine was in the back, which tended to make the front lighter and affected the steering handling because of this setup. There was talk of putting a paving slab in the front luggage compartment to improve handling, although I don't remember my dad resorting to this. There was synchromesh on all four gears, which was radical, having been described as impossible by Sir Alec Isigonis, the designer of the Mini, and this made it easier to engage first gear at junctions. There was a hatchback window at the rear, and the back seat folded down for load carrying. This may be useful if you'd filled your front boot with paving slabs. The engine was aluminium, making it lighter, and featured an overhead camshaft. All of this made it different from the ubiquitous and rather more successful Mini, and personally made it difficult to transition between the two cars while learning to drive. Nevertheless, I passed my test at the first attempt and can still remember the eerie sense of freedom being in my dad's car by myself. In those days, in-car entertainment was mostly limited to your own singing and the intrusive noise of the car engine and the road noise, plus any sounds your passengers might make. I was able to experience this firsthand shortly after passing my test, when my dad was foolish or kind enough, depending on your perspective, to let me borrow the Imp one evening. I collected a couple of friends. I believe beer was drunk. An attempt was made to settle an argument caused by an article in the motoring press. This stated that a Hillman Imp was capable of 70 miles per hour in third gear, while a Mini wasn't. Driving on the nearest dual carriageway out of Swansea, the little blue car was wound up to the mid-60s miles per hour in third, but seemed reluctant to edge the speedometer needle beyond the 70 mark. One of our number suggested changing up to fourth gear, exceeding the 70 mile an hour mark, and changing gear down into third, and to see if that worked. The effect did indeed show 70 miles an hour briefly in third, before the combined effect of the car lurching, the engine and the car's occupants screaming in unison, meant that the experience, while arguably successful, was short-lived and never, ever to be repeated. We drove home sedately, watching the car's temperature gauge hovering near the red mark. My father, when he welcomed me back onto the drive at home, thought the engine smelled hot and remarked that he must check the water and oil levels, as he couldn't remember when he had last done that. The descriptions that follow about my own cars will not be a technical list of details that would be of interest to automotive enthusiasts, but rather my own take on the cars, their idiosyncrasies and the adventures and mishaps that I enjoyed during their ownership. There will be an ability to vaguely trace car design and innovation over the decades, with a number of examples of improvements that were viewed as luxuries or major advances at the time, to soon become essentials and mainstream. My Austin A35. My own first car, an Austin A35, was less technically advanced than the Hillman Imp, but nevertheless provided a more independent way of getting to my second year of university. The car was a very old-fashioned design produced between 1956 and 1959, a rounded, friendly bodywork shape, the front of which is recognisable today as a van version used in the Wallace and Gromit films as the bakery van. The A35 was quite old-fashioned looking, and I was mildly jealous of my university friend Cledwin, who owned the much more modern-looking A40. more angular and with early hatchback rear door, though this envy was tempered by a stronger jealousy of another friend's Trant Spitfire, which seemed the last word in style and sophistication. So thanks, Mike, for sowing the seeds in my mind that may have led me to eventually own one a few years later. I believe that my A35 was from 1958 and I owned it in 1971. It had some refinements. The bonnet had been replaced with one from another car. The car was black, whilst the bonnet was grey, and wasn't entirely fitted properly, so it was held down with two leather straps and buckles. This was apparently common in earlier sports cars, such as the 1930s Blower Bentleys, with which other racing features mine did not share. Strangely, while researching and writing for this book, I came across a photo of one of my dad's early cars from my childhood, which was a grey Austin A30. Could the bonnet have been a later transplant donation onto my black A35, and hence the poor fitting? Spooky. It did possess one feature, similar to James Bond's Aston Martin, in the form of a sort of ejector seat. The passenger seat wasn't consistently secured to the floor, so that occasionally, when in motion and perhaps the result of over-exuberant racing gear changes, the front fixings would release, pivoting the whole seat and the passenger backwards, like Bond's ejector seat. I would have preferred the front-facing machine guns, but you can't have everything. Reading the motoring website specification of the model, they extol the virtues of a flashing indicator bulb over the previous A30's model's indicator arms, which on many earlier cars popped out of the side of the car to indicate turning. Quite quaint, really. This exciting development must not have been fully debugged on my car, as the dashboard switch for this had been replaced with a cheap metal toggle switch, which not only didn't self-cancel, but didn't flash to tell me when they were on. And I'm sure I spent a large proportion of my journeys flashing the last direction of turn for a number of miles, making for a certain amount of confusion amongst fellow road users. Many car designers in the quest for greater speed go to great lengths to reduce the weight of their cars and also reduce air resistance by removing unnecessary projections and protuberances. I accidentally achieved this one night when my rear bumper became unfixed at one end and alerted me to the mishap by a loud scraping noise in the rear and a cloud of sparks visible in the rearview mirror. Pulling over, I found it was insecurely fastened on the side where it was still attached, so it came away with a quick tug. I found it just fitted into the boot, where it stayed for a few weeks, with the car enjoying the new streamlined look while not actually gaining any weight reduction. It transpired that not opting for the weight reduction option by leaving the bumper at home was to prove beneficial to me. Several weeks later, I was pulled over by the police late one night, and having checked my driving licence and established the tyres weren't bald and the car's lights were all functioning, including the non-cancelling indicators, the officer was jubilant to notice the missing rear bumper. "Where's your rear bumper?" I responded by opening the boot to show him. In fairness to him, I could see he was doing his best not to laugh, so to my relief he muttered, "Get off home and have it fixed tomorrow." This was a satisfactory end to the matter. Sadly, this was not the most dramatic event in my car, although miraculously I never had an accident in it, despite driving it as fast as the tiny engine would allow it. No, the drama was provided by the car itself, attempting to convert itself into a three-wheeler, which was popular design for cheap cars at the time. I didn't ever own one until one afternoon driving in Gower, when the car just didn't feel right rounding a bend. And as I drove into the next bend, on the road crossing Clyne Common, the car felt a whole lot stranger as simultaneously it lurched to the left, dropped in height, accompanied by a terrible grinding noise, and I spotted a wheel heading down the road in front of me, before realising that this may well be one of the wheels that had previously been attached to the car. The two following cars, driven by friends, came to a halt, having managed to drive round me when I drowned to a halt. There was a long scrape on the road surface and thankfully there didn't seem to be any fluids leaking out from under the car. One friend arrived back rolling the errant wheel and cheerfully told me the wheel nuts were still inside, held in place by the hub gap. Another friend optimistically told me that the threads on the hub looked okay and hadn't been stripped so the wheel could go back on. Between the three cars we had two car jacks, both of the flimsy scissor type, and not suitable to raise the car from its lowly position. A garage was known to be a short way up the road, so an expedition was sent off to borrow a trolley jack. This being post-1960s, and as a group there was an air of Led Zeppelin's roadies about us, the garage owner demanded security that was provided by leaving a watch with them. The trolley jack did the trick. The wheel was put back on. My then-girlfriend was reassured by all that the car would be perfectly safe, and so she somewhat reluctantly got back in. She was entitled to a certain amount of caution, as she had recently experienced the ejector seat feature on a previous outing. After a short debate as to whether the watch should be a fair swap for the trolley jack, it was returned to the garage, and we all drove somewhere for a reviving coffee. Fortunately, the car remained a four-wheeler for the rest of my ownership. During my experience of cars, either as a passenger or a driver, reliability has improved by a huge margin. There's no better example of this than the seconds before driving off. In my early cars, there was always the air of anticipation when turning the key to start the engine. Would it fire? Was there even enough electricity in the battery to fire the starting motor to turn the engine? There are always particular routines required. Some recommended a quick depression of the accelerator to prime the fuel. There was usually in older cars a choke lever to pull out, which temporarily restricted airflow to the carburetor, and which you had to remember to push back in once the engine was warmed up. If these routines didn't work in post-war cars, there was the option of the manual starter handle. This was a form of hand crank inserted into the front of the car and allowed the car engine to be turned over to start. That is, if the person winding the handle was strong enough and usually required synchronisation with someone sitting in the car performing the aforementioned pedal depression or choke operation, and if unsuccessful, this person was usually accused of flooding the engine by the red-faced and sweating operator of the winding handle. It was not usually a happy operation. More fun could be had with cars without a hand cranking option by bump starting the car. This requires one or more willing helpers to push the car while the driver inside, having put the car in neutral gear and released the handbrake, turns on the ignition and makes a judgment at a point when the car has achieved sufficient speed to start. When one of the forward gears are engaged, potential problems are to employ a car-related term manifold. Firstly, there are likely to be accusations thrown by the breathless helpers who are pushing at the driver sitting in the car that the handbrake is not completely released, that the ignition is not on, or the wrong gear has been selected, hopefully not reverse, as this would turn mere frustration into potential disaster if the car started. Again, there are same potential pitfalls of choke or flooding errors. Even if the car is successful in starting, at best the pushers are usually enveloped in a smelly and smoky cloud of exhaust gas as the car engine suddenly bursts into life. Of course, they may be unfortunate to have avoided this by the unsatisfactory tactic of being so surprised at the car starting and lurching forward away from them that they end up face down and prone in the road. Neither option is ideal. I'm sorry to say I've witnessed and participated in both scenarios. For almost a whole half term at university, my A35 gave me multiple opportunities to witness and practice these as the starter motor failed, and I either couldn't get a replacement or, more likely, I temporarily didn't have the funds to replace it. My student flat was at the top of a steep hill in Aberystwyth, with the shops, friends and a much social life on the level near the seafront. Leaving the flat wasn't so difficult, but I often had to bribe friends with a free ride back up to the campus, providing they participated in the bump start exercise. I also can claim to have performed the procedure solo, quite an act of derring do, as it required a quiet, wide road, ideally sloping downhill, and after a shove from outside the driver's open door, you had to leap into the car and perform the ignition, choke, throttle, gear engagement routine while steering it back on a straight course. I got quite adept at it and was told it had an entertainment value as a spectacle. Another method of starting was through the use of jump leads, a set of heavy-duty cables, usually one red and one black, with a large set of sprung clamps, known for obvious reasons as crocodile clips, at each end. You would connect your car engine to a donor car's electrical system, and while the air engine was running, you would use their electrics to power your starter. As students, you first had to find someone else's car that started reliably. The required set of jump leads, correct connections, and the madness to muck about with cables under the bonnet of a car with the engine running, assuming it had started. There was also the added excitement of generating electrical sparks in an engine bay likely to harbour escaped petrol fumes and a reasonable number of oily surfaces. Life had its excitement and random dangers in those days. In a modern car, this is not often performed as it's not usually required, but if it is required, connections are usually masked by plastic shrouding that disguises the component engine parts. I can't find any photos of my A35, despite being very proud of it, but I do have a photo of my dad's A30, which is very similar in appearance. Roadside repairs were quite a commonplace event in those days, and a combination of the relative simplicity of cars at that time, the optimism of youth, coupled with the lack of funds for more professional help, all served to help with this. I recall two events performed on my father's cars, one without his knowledge and one with. His Hillman Imp was lent to me on occasions, and on one such loan, on a run with friends to a Gower Beach, the car refused to move. I believe we'd stopped at Shepherd's in Park Mill to buy food and drink for a picnic. While attempting to pull away, not only didn't the car move, but the inertia was accompanied by a loud clanking noise from underneath the rear of the car. Getting out and crawling underneath revealed some large kind of octagonal rubber donut split in two that was the link between the drive shaft and the rear wheel. Checking the other side revealed it should indeed be in one whole piece. Youthful optimism suggested that if a replacement could be obtained, the repair would be possible. A call from a nearby phone box to a spares garage in Swansea located the required part and could be collected from them. Those were the days, phone boxes and copies of Yellow Pages, no smartphones and Google searches. An hour later, my friend Jeff arrived back with the rubber donut part and a toolkit. Amazingly, the nuts and bolts holding the old part were removed relatively easily. The new part fitted and the beach picnic resumed. My father was never told about the repair, and our mechanical knowledge had marginally been extended. This knowledge was rashly employed a few years later when, after leaving university, I was back at home waiting to start my first proper job as a graduate trainee with a power company in the southeast of England. One day, my father announced that the engine in his Ford Cortina had a broken piston ring and it had seized while emerging from the garage at home. Having time on my hands and full of youthful bravado, I announced that I was sure we could replace the rings and repair it at home. As my father was working full time, the we mostly meant me, so armed with the appropriate Haynes manual, a borrowed socket set, and a large tin of Swarfiga, which is a luminous green jelly-like degreaser for cleaning your hands. Although I'd never attempted anything so ambitious mechanically before, I was sure it was possible, and also felt this would be a useful start to my career in the engineering sector, although thankfully my role was to be in an administrative function and safely away from the operation of the power network. I have to say, despite a long career, I never fully understood the product or even how electricity stays in the wall when there's no plug in the socket. After several greasy days in the garage with the car and many cups of coffee and hours of radio, I somehow managed to remove the old piston rings and install all new ones in the four cylinders and reinstall it all in the engine block. The triumph was short-lived as, despite several attempts, the engine would not turn over or start. Some days later, I was relieved to hear when phoning home from my new job in Kent that my dad and a friend had bump-started the car by towing it, and after a bang and a roar, the engine was running fine. Proved this to me sometime later by visiting me in Folkestone. Wisely, I refrained from offering any mechanical expertise in my new career. Not long after entering the world of permanent employment, I decided that I should re-enter the world of car ownership. This had come to an abrupt end while at university when a failed MOT on multiple issues meant I sold the A35 for scrap after a year's ownership.